Pacifica. This is Democracy Now! We're on the road in Stanford, California. Civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart has been ordered to prison to begin serving a 2.5-year sentence after a federal appeals court upheld her conviction. She was found guilty in 2005 of distributing press releases on behalf of her jailed client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. In a Democracy Now! National Broadcast exclusive, a conversation with Lynn Stewart in our studio in New York. Then as California faces a massive budget crisis, we speak with UC Berkeley professor George Lakoff. He sent the state attorney general a ballot proposition called the California Democracy Act. It would roll back the two-thirds majority needed to pass a budget and, he says, end the gridlock created by minority rule. And the card game. We talked to veteran investigative journalist Lowell Bergman about the secret history of the credit card industry. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New government figures show Wall Street's on pace to have its most profitable year to date. On Tuesday, the New York Comptroller's Office said Wall Street profits are set to exceed the record set 3 years ago before the onset of the nation's financial meltdown. The four largest firms, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, and J.P. Morgan Chase, took in $22.5 billion in profits through September. The top six banks set aside $112 billion for salaries and bonuses over the same period. In a statement, New York Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli said, quote, "The national economy is slowly improving, but Wall Street has recovered much faster than anyone had envisioned." The U.S. and China say they may propose targets for emissions cuts at next month's climate summit in Copenhagen. On Tuesday, President Obama and Chinese President Hu Jintao issued a joint declaration saying, quote, "An agreed outcome at Copenhagen should include emission reduction targets of developed countries." The Obama administration's already announced it will only reach an interim political agreement in Copenhagen while postponing a binding treaty until next year. Obama wraps up his visit to China today. The New York Times reports the White House has declined proposals for brief meetings with Chinese political activists, as well as lawyers, during Obama's trip. The Senate, meanwhile, has followed Obama's deferral of a climate treaty with a delay of its own. On Tuesday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said climate legislation will now be put off until the spring. The news comes as dozens of environment ministers have wrapped up a preparatory meeting in Copenhagen ahead of next month's summit. Danish climate and energy minister Connie Hedegaard said the world's awaiting concrete action from the U.S. on climate change.
We all know the difficulties with the American Senate, but I also hope that our American friends feel that there is worldwide expectations that they will deliver in Copenhagen. And I must say that I also interpret what President Obama said today and also what he said in conjunction with the APEC meeting, that they know that they have to deliver also figures in Copenhagen.
Outside the climate talks, dozens of protesters rallied outside the meeting to protest the plans to delay a legally binding agreement. The activists staged a die-in, lying immobile on the ground to symbolize those who would lose their lives because of global warming.
These ministers are now working on a mandate of delay rather than a mandate of possibility, and we need to change this. Climate change is causing over 300,000 people's lives to be lost every year.
Meanwhile, in Ethiopia, a meeting of African Union leaders has renewed calls for Western reparations to address the effects of global warming. The Ethiopian Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, said climate change will continue to have devastating consequences on Africa.
The African Union, in its two previous summits, made a historic decision to engage actively in climate change negotiations, and to do so on the basis of a common position and one negotiating team. This was an unprecedented and historic decision. Africa has contributed virtually nothing to global warming, but it is placed to lose most by climate change. Africa is going to be hit hardest and it's going to be hit first.
NATO's Secretary General says a major troop increase in Afghanistan is on the way. Anders Fogh Rasmussen made the pledge Tuesday at a NATO assembly in Scotland.
In a few weeks, I expect we will decide in NATO on the approach and troop levels needed to take our mission forward. I'm confident it will be a counter-insurgency approach with substantially more troops and will place the Afghan population at the core of ISAF's collective effort.
A top U.S. military officer has confirmed Army suicides will reach a new record annual high. General Peter Chiarelli, the U.S. Army Vice Chief of Staff, said Tuesday the number of soldiers to take their own lives in 2009 has already matched last year's record of 140. The figure does not include an additional 71 soldiers who killed themselves this year after leaving active duty.
We are almost certainly going to end the year higher than last year. Obviously, we would prefer not to have another suicide this year or in the years that follow. But we know that will not be the case. This is horrible. And I do not want to downplay the significance of these numbers in any way.
In Israel and the occupied territories, the Israeli government has announced a new round of settlement expansion on occupied Palestinian land. Israel says it'll build 900 new homes in the East Jerusalem settlement of Gilo. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs criticized the plan, saying, quote, "We are dismayed." But the move comes just 2 weeks after the Obama administration tacitly approved settlement expansion by hailing an Israeli pledge to slow down construction, not halt it completely. Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki called for meaningful international pressure on Israel.
The international community should really understand that these measures and these actions taken by Israel are intended to prevent the Palestinian state from happening, and they want really to maintain the occupation as long as possible. One should really react to this, and it's not enough for the international community to keep saying that settlement activities are illegal. I think, you know, it's time for the international community to intervene and to stop such settlement activities from taking place. Because, you know, they are making a solution
In a statement, the Israeli government dismissed opposition to the new construction, which it called, quote, a routine process. In El Salvador, six Jesuit priests are being honored 20 years after their murders by the U.S.-backed Salvadoran military. On Monday, the priests were bestowed the nation's highest civilian award, marking the first time the Salvadoran government has honored the priests since their deaths. In a ceremony attended by the priests' families, Salvadoran President Mauricio Funes said his country's, quote, pulling back a heavy veil of darkness and lies to let in the light of justice and truth. El Salvador's defense minister also announced the military is ready to ask for forgiveness and opens its archives to a long-sought investigation. The Jesuits had been outspoken advocates for the poor and critics of human rights abuses committed by the Arena government. They were killed on November 16, 1989, when a military unit entered the Central American University campus and shot them to death. The priest's housekeeper and her daughter were also killed in the attack. The current head of the university, priest Jose Maria Tejera, welcomed the posthumous recognition.
Many people from all parties, of course, Arena as well, commented before those priests were great men who helped to end the war before because their martyrdom pushed to accelerate peace talks. But never in 20 years were there an official word of recognition for these people's dignity. This is the first time, and I think it is a very important symbol that should be open to all victims from El Salvador.
The order to kill the priests is widely believed to have come from senior Arena Party and military leaders, but no high-ranking military or government official has ever been charged. In Honduras, lawmakers have again delayed a decision on restoring the ousted president, Manuel Zelaya. Honduran congressional leader José Saavedra says the assembly won't vote on Zelaya's return until after this month's scheduled presidential elections. Zelaya has warned he won't return to office after the election, saying doing so would legitimize the June coup that overthrew him. In Iran, state media is reporting five people have received death sentences for taking part in the protests against the disputed national elections earlier this year. More than 100 opposition activists have gone on trial for their alleged role in the unrest. At least three others have also been sentenced to death. Back in the United States, the Senate has rejected an amendment that would bar funding for jailing Guantanamo prisoners in U.S. prisons. The vote marks a shift from May, when the Senate overwhelmingly rejected funding for closing Guantanamo and moving prisoners to U.S. soil. Obama administration officials are preparing to visit an Illinois prison this week as a potential site for Guantanamo prisoners. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn is supporting the plan, which would move less than 100 prisoners to the jail.
It's a state-of-the-art prison that was built about 8 years ago. It has about 1,600 beds.
That had been closed after its workers voted to unionize. United Students Against Sweatshops says the sportswear giant Russell Athletic has agreed to rehire some 1,200 Honduran workers that were dismissed last January. The move follows a nationwide campaign that pressured investors and forced dozens of collegiate athletics departments to sever or restrict their licensing deals with Russell. And in Illinois, graduate teaching assistants at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign have voted to end a two-day strike. The Graduate Teachers Union says school administrators agreed to meet union's four key demands, including protections for tuition waivers, health benefits, and job security. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, on the road in Stanford, California. Civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart has been ordered to prison to begin serving a 2.5-year sentence after a federal appeals court upheld her conviction on Tuesday. Lynn Stewart was found guilty in 2005 of distributing press releases on behalf of her jailed client, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, also known as the Blind Sheikh, who's serving a life sentence on terror-related charges. Prosecutors had sought a 30-year sentence. But Stewart was sentenced to 2.5 years after the judge rejected the prosecutor's argument that she threatened national security and ruled there was no evidence her actions caused any harm. On Tuesday, a three-judge appeals court panel ordered the trial judge to revoke Stewart's bond and said she must begin serving her 28-month sentence. The panel rejected Stewart's claim she was acting only as a zealous advocate for her imprisoned client when she passed messages for him. The appellate ruling said, quote, "A genuinely held intent to represent a client zealously is not necessarily inconsistent with criminal intent." The panel also described Stewart's 28-month sentence as, quote, "strikingly low," and sent the case back to the trial judge to determine whether she deserved a longer prison term. The ruling said Stewart, who's 70 years old, was to surrender to U.S. Marshals immediately. But her lawyers won her an extension until at least 5 p.m. today. Well, Lynn Stewart has come to our studios here in New York, and we welcome you, Lynn, to Democracy Now! Can you describe your reaction to the ruling?
Well, in its sweeping and negative tone, I must say I was first a little bit shocked, because we had expected, or had hoped at least, that some of these important constitutional issues would be decided, and then very disappointed. On my own behalf, certainly, personally, you can't discount. But actually, for all of us, Amy, because these important constitutional issues, the right to speak to your lawyer privately without the government listening in, the right to be safe from having a search conducted of your lawyer's office, all these things are now swept under the rug and available to the government.
Can you, for people who haven't followed your case, explain exactly what happened, why you were charged?
I represented Sheikh Omar at trial. That was in 1995, along with Ramsey Clark and Abdin Jabara. I was lead trial counsel. He was convicted in September of 95, sentenced to a life prison plus 100 years, or some one of the usual outlandish sentences. We continued, all three of us, to visit him while he was in jail. He was a a political client. That means that he is targeted by the government, and because it is so important to prisoners to be able to have access to their lawyers. Sometime in 1998, I think maybe it was, they imposed severe restrictions on him. That is, his ability to communicate with the outside world, to have interviews, to be able to even call his family was limited by something called special administrative measures. The lawyers were asked to sign on for these special administrative measures and warned that if these measures were not adhered to, they could indeed lose contact with their client, in other words, be removed from his case. In 2000, I visited the sheikh, and he asked me to make a press release. This press release had to do with the current status of an organization that at that point was basically defunct, the Jamaat Islamiya, and I agreed to do that. In May of—maybe it was later than that, sometime in 2000, I made the press release. Interestingly enough, we found out later that the Clinton administration under Janet Reno had the option to prosecute me, and they declined to do so, based on the notion that without lawyers like me or the late Bill Kunstler or many that I could name, the cause of justice is not well served. They need the gadflies. So at any rate, they made me sign on to the agreement again not to do this. They did not stop me from representing him. I continued to represent him. And it was only after 9/11 in April of 2002 that John Ashcroft came to New York, announced the indictment of me, my paralegal, and the interpreter for the case on grounds of materially aiding a terrorist organization. One of the footnotes to the case, of course, is that Ashcroft also appeared on nationwide television with Letterman that night, ballyhooing the great work of Bush's Justice Department in indicting and making the world safe from terrorism. The course of the case followed. We tried the case in 2005 to a jury, of course, sitting not 10 blocks from the World Trade Center, and an anonymous jury, I might add, which I think went a long way to contribute to our convictions, and all three of us were convicted. Since that time, the appeals process has followed. The appeal was argued almost 2 years ago, and the opinion just came like a—actually like a thunderclap yesterday. And to just put it in perspective, I think, it comes hard on the heels of Holder's announcement that they are bringing the men from Guantanamo to New York to be tried. That's—I'll expand on that if you wish, but that basically is where we're at. It said that I should be immediately remanded, my bail revoked.
Lynn, I wanted to read you from the Times their description, saying in addressing whether Stewart's sentence was too lenient, Judge Sack wrote that Judge Codal had cited her extraordinary personal characteristics and had described her as a dedicated public servant who had throughout her career represented the poor, the disadvantaged, and the unpopular. But Judge Codal had declined to determine whether Ms. Stewart had lied at trial, a factor he should have considered in weighing her sentence. Judge Sack wrote, "We think that whether Stewart lied under oath at her trial is directly relevant to whether her sentence was appropriate." What are they talking about? What is their accusation about you lying at trial?
Well, of course, I'm not rendering a legal opinion here, Amy, because I'm officially disbarred. But I will say that my understanding of the law is that the judge may consider whether or not a client or a person who testified in their own defense lied or even shaded the truth to their own benefit. And my sense of reading—and I haven't read them over recently—but my sense of the sentencing was that the judge did consider it, at least in a manner. He basically said he did not think it was relevant, and the Court of Appeals argued with this. I, of course, committed no perjury. I spoke on my own behalf. I described what I did. I'm not sure that the Court of Appeals may have liked what I said, but that is, you know, because the U.S. attorney went into my politics at great length, as if to say, see, she has radical politics, so we know she would have done something radical. I've always said my politics are very, very different from the Sheikh's politics, and that was an unfair cut. But notwithstanding that, they do have the right to consider it. It can be something, if the judge believed you lied, that can increase your sentence. I have every reason to believe that Judge Kotel, who is a most careful judge, a most a judge described in the opinion by Judge Calabresi as being someone who makes very wise decisions, considered it, rejected it, and went ahead. This was the number, the sentence he arrived at, 28 months. And we hope that he will retain the courage that he had in making that sentence to stick with it now that the government, through the Second Circuit, has challenged it.
Lynn Stewart, as you were being sentenced in 2006, you had breast cancer. How are you today? How's your health?
Breast cancer is good. I have no recurrence. I just had a mammogram, even though I'm 70. I don't know how that falls into the new warnings, but at any rate, I'm cancer-free. I have some other aging problems, a woman plumbing stuff, which I actually am scheduled for surgery on December 7th. My lawyers are hoping to be able to go to the Second Circuit and ask them to extend the period of time that I would have to surrender in order that this surgery may be accomplished right here in New York at Lenox Hill Hospital. We're not sure of that. It does seem that—
Can you explain how this happens today? Because at this point, you have an extension until 5 p.m. today before—
Yes.
—going to prison. What will happen today?
Well, the judge has asked the lawyers to research whether he has the power at this point. I mean, this is like ancient English Magna Carta law. You know, the case has been appealed. It's in the Second Circuit. In order for him to order me to prison, it has to be before him. In other words, the papers, I guess, have to be carried from the upper floor to the lower floor, to the district court. He wanted them to research whether or not he can do anything before he has that mandate. He, of course, can decide that I'm turning myself in tomorrow. He can also decide that he doesn't have it until usually the mandate takes a week to 10 days to come down. So we're sort of on the edge. It will not preclude my lawyers from going to the circuit directly and asking them to stay their order of my immediate remand and revocation of bail. So we're sort of on the edge.
Do you know where you will be imprisoned?
Say that again?
Do you know where you will be imprisoned?
No, see, that's one of the other reasons. It's not only my surgery. It also is the fact that I've never been designated, and also the fact that the pre-sentence report on which they usually base these designations is 3 years old at this point. It doesn't take into account anything that has happened since then. So we think there's some grounds for extending the time, but I think it's fair to say that at this point, I have brought my books and my medicines with me to go to court this afternoon, and I expect the worst, being Irish, but hope for the best, because I'm a leftist and always optimistic.
What books have you brought with you?
I have Snow by I never pronounce his name right, Orhan Pamuk. I have The Field of Poppies. I can't remember the author. Terrible. Given to me by a dear comrade, Ralph Schoenman. And I have a couple of mysteries, because I'm an addict of mysteries, and it passes the time quickly for me.
Lynn, would you do anything differently today? Or would you do anything differently back then if you knew what you knew today?
I think I should have been a little more savvy that the government would come after me. But do anything differently? I don't. I'd like to think I would not do anything differently, Amy. I made these decisions based on my understanding of what the client needed, what a lawyer was expected to do. They say that you can't distinguish zeal from criminal intent sometimes. I had no criminal intent whatsoever. This was a considered decision based on the need of the client. And although some people have said press releases aren't client needs, I think keeping a person alive when they are in prison, held under the conditions which we now know to be torture, totally incognito, not incognito, but totally held without any contact with the outside world except a phone call once a month to his family and to his lawyers. I think it was necessary. I would do it again. I might handle it a little differently, but I would do it again.
Lynn Stewart, I want to thank you for being with us. I hope we can talk to you in prison. Lynn Stewart has been sentenced to 2.5 years in jail to be served beginning today unless a judge is able to intervene. Thanks so much for being with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're in California and Stanford, and we're going to be going to Berkeley after break to talk about the budget crisis and also to look at the card game, the secret history of the credit card, with Frontline's Lowell Bergman. Stay with us.
Who in your merry, merry month of May, who by very slow decay, and who shall I say is calling? And who in her lonely slip, who by barbiturate, who in these realms of love, by something blunt, who by avalanche, who by powder, who for his greed, who for his hunger, and who shall I say is calling?
Leonard Cohen, Who by Fire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're on the road in California. Tonight, we'll be in Santa Barbara speaking at Campbell Hall. We'll be moving on to Chico, to Davis, to Los Angeles. You can check our website at democracynow.org as we break the sound barrier and support community media around this country. We're broadcasting on over 800 stations on Pacific and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at Democracy Now! Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 250 are. As we turn now to the budget crisis here in California. The state faces a projected deficit of $21 billion, according to a new report from the state's budget analysts. The prospect for further cuts loom. I'm joined now from Berkeley, California, by a man who says the real cause of the state's fiscal problems is its dysfunctional system of government. George Lakoff, an author, progressive activist, professor of cognitive science and linguistics at University of California, Berkeley. He has sent the attorney general a ballot proposition for the 2010 ballot that he says can end the gridlock in the state legislature. It's called the California Democracy Act and reads, quote, all legislative action on revenue and budget must be determined by a majority vote. It changes two words in the state's constitution, turning two-thirds to majority in two places. It would roll back the two-thirds majority needed to pass a budget, and Lakoff argues, end the gridlock created by minority rule in the state. George Lakoff joining us now from the University of California, Berkeley. I welcome you to Democracy Now! Lay out what your proposal is, Professor Lakoff.
It's a pleasure to be here, Amy. The proposal is very simple, namely, end minority rule by simply having the majority decide on economic, day-to-day economic issues. That's what this says. It says on revenue and budget, let the majority in the legislature, decide these things, just as happens in 47 other states. California is the only state in the union that is completely a matter that has minority rule in the legislature on both issues.
How did it happen? What is the history of this?
The history was back in the 30s, there was a two-thirds rule on the budget put in. And then in Prop 13, back in the 1970s, over 30 years ago, there was a hidden part of Prop 13. Most people thought Prop 13 was primarily about and only about property taxes. And that said that you needed a two-thirds rule locally to raise property taxes. What was hidden in there was the idea that you needed two-thirds rule to raise any taxes in the entire state. And that meant that the legislature was basically under minority rule, that one-third plus one, 34%, could thwart the majority on any major economic issue simply by saying no until the majority gave in.
So what is the reaction to your proposal?
We don't know yet, because it's not out there yet. And in fact, there has been a reaction by the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General changed the wording of the proposal. It's in its description, although it doesn't change the initiative in any way. They put a wording on it that said that this changes the vote requirement to pass a budget and to raise taxes, quote unquote. Now, that's misleading for the following reason. You can raise revenue without raising a tax rate at all, say by plugging loopholes. If you say raise taxes, most people mean it means raise taxes on them significantly. But if the majority runs the state, then the majority can decide whether or not taxes should be raised on them, or whether taxes should be raised at all or lowered, or whether loopholes should be plugged to raise revenue, or whether revenue should be raised by selling oil to oil companies rather than just giving it away. There are many ways to raise revenue. That's what our initiative said. And it also didn't say whether you should raise it or lower it. It just said, let the majority in the state run the state. And the people of California, I think, have been maligned. Most of the people in California, most of the voters, I think, are quite reasonable and responsible. They have voted for a majority of legislators who are reasonable and responsible. But it's a minority, a conservative minority, that does not want any public service run by the state, that only wants that wants basically everything privatized. That says no. That says, no to all of the majority's proposals. And that's why we have gridlock in the state. That's why budgets don't get passed on time. And it's why public services all over the state, including the closing of, the firing of many teachers, tens of thousands of teachers in the state, the closing of parks, the closing of health facilities and so on throughout the state has been happening, largely because that minority is running our state government.
Talk about what's happening now, a major strike taking place on California campuses. The Board of Regents, we dealt with this some yesterday on Democracy Now! With Professor Roy, Professor Nader, and students who are leading the Solidarity Strike. What is the climate like right now, and what do you think other options are in dealing with the budget, Professor Lykoff?
Well, privatization is the cause of the problems in this state, that is, because of minority rule. Therefore, the budget in the state going to the universities has been cut, and Governor Schwarzenegger also wants to privatize the universities. Within the universities, privatization has begun. And that means many things. It means that student fees and tuition have gone up very considerably, 32% next year, but it had been going up before that as well. It means that all sorts of people have been laid off who are needed. It means that programs as unpopular in the sense of not having a lot of people in them are being cut. And universities are there to have things like languages and so on taught. There are cuts all over the place that are there because of the budget cuts, but these are also made because of decisions inside the university to move in the direction of privatization. The people who are striking are saying that this was a wrong move, that even within the university right now, other funds and other funding decisions could have been made that would have prevented all of these layoffs, furloughs, and program cuts, and that could have prevented the rise in student fees. That is something that the faculty has been trying to determine and has been showing that bit by bit, as we get more information, that it's true that many of these cuts could have been avoided, you know, under other circumstances, although we don't know yet because it's hard to get information out of the university administration. The strike is going to happen, and it's mainly a union-led strike. The Save the University Committee of the faculty is not sponsoring but is supporting that strike. And that is going to happen today. As I walked in here, there were strikers out there.
And we should say that, as you walked in, there is at 5 o'clock in the morning, California time. So that's an early time to, for strikers to be gathering. Can you put, George Lykoff, this story of the massive education cuts affecting people in the Cal State system even more than University of California system, in the context of what's happening in the world today, of the context of the United States? President Obama expected to announce any day now his decision on Afghanistan, on expanding the war in Afghanistan. About the budget cuts at home, the latest issue of the study of hunger come out of the Agriculture Department saying 1 in 6 people in this country went hungry last year. Hunger, the cuts to education, and the context of the war.
What is being said is there's just no money, as if it's a force of nature, but it's not a force of nature. These economic conditions are the result of human action and human decision, and those decisions could have been made otherwise and can be made otherwise. Right now, we have an economic disaster and an ecological disaster upon us, and those two disasters have the same cause, namely short-term greed combined with a lack of an understanding of systemic risk, of how systems work both in ecology and in the economy. You put those together, and you have the same cause for twin disasters. And the argument is that it just happened that way, but it didn't just happen that way. The move to say that there's only private interest, not public interest, is what is behind all of this. It is what has what led the Republican administrations from Reagan on to cut regulators throughout the government and to try to privatize as many things as possible. That has led to all kinds of disasters all around, both in the ecological sphere and in the economic sphere.
Finally, your assessment of President Obama at this point, a year later?
It's hard to tell. He made a choice in choosing Rahm Emanuel to try to twist arms in Congress and to, let's say, on the health care issue and on the environment, to go issue by issue, that is, part by part of health care, instead of just saying, hey, we have a great American plan for Americans' health, and here are all the parts of it, but it's one plan, and that's what makes sense of it. Instead, they went for the parts. That is, they said, it doesn't matter whether we have a single health care plan, but we're going to get more people insured, we're going to get rid of preconditions, and so on and so on. And they gave out a list of parts. Over the summer, the president said, look, it doesn't matter whether we actually get the public option or not, as long as this long list is carried out. And then he gave like two dozen long lists, a laundry list. And David Axelrod wrote on Organizing for America, here are the 24 things that we want changed, three groups of eight. Nobody's going to remember the 24 things, and each of them can be attacked separately by insurance companies. That decision, the decision to go point by point rather than for the whole, has affected the healthcare debate in a very, very bad way. And the same thing has happened in the Waxman-Markey bill, which essentially said, we're not going to just say we have to cut global warming carbon dioxide emissions, but simply said we're going to go and do this long list, 1,500 pages of it, which essentially sort of kills the bill in a lot of ways and gives huge amounts of money to industry that should be going to the American people. Maria Cantwell has an alternative bill that's 32 pages long and very simple, called CLEAR, that actually would cut global warming emissions and at the same time function as a stimulus bill because it would give three-quarters of the permit money for emissions back to the American people and would only essentially cap the distribution of fuel, not the burning of it, which is easy to check on and easy to monitor, whereas if you've got hundreds of thousands of places to check, you can't possibly check them. So basically, Maria Cantwell's bill is a much better bill than what we have now under Waxman-Markey, but for the same reason, namely, it does a single job and it does it well, and it doesn't try to break it up into, you know, hundreds and hundreds of special cases.
Professor Lykoff, I want to thank you for being with us. Professor Lykoff is a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. We're broadcasting from Stanford, California, as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour. When we come back from break, we'll be joined by Frontline and UC Berkeley professor Lowell Bergman on the credit card industry, the card game. Stay with us. Too cold for me. Billy Preston, nothing from nothing. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on the road in Stanford, California. I'll be headed to Santa Barbara tonight, speaking at Campbell Hall, celebrating the community radio station KCSB. And then we're on to Los Angeles and Chico and Davis. And go to our website, democracynow.org, and check out the tour through the West and the Northwest as we end today's show with a look at how the consumer loan industry continues to squeeze customers. Last year, the Federal Reserve Board announced new rules for banks to remove unfair credit card practices. And in May of this year, Congress passed the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility and Disclosure Act of 2009. Both will only become effective next February. But in the meantime, banks have raised interest rates, imposed higher fees and reduced credit lines on customers before the new rules can take effect. The House voted earlier this month to make the rules effective immediately. Senate Banking Committee Chair Chris Dodd is pushing to freeze interest rates on existing credit card balances until the law takes effect. And this Thursday, the Senate Banking Committee will take up the proposal to create a Consumer Finance Protection Agency. How will all the new rules change the way banks function, and how much can they protect consumers? That's the subject of a joint Frontline New York Times investigation called The Card Game. Longtime investigative journalist and Frontline correspondent Lowell Bergman talked to industry insiders, lobbyists, politicians, and consumer advocates about how to reform the way the consumer loan industry has done business for decades. I'll be joined in a minute by Lowell Bergman, but first, here's an excerpt of his new documentary, The Card Game. Here, Lowell Bergman talks to Nessa Fetis, the vice president of the American Bankers Association, and Shailesh Mehta, the former CEO of Providian Bank. He asked Mehta to look over a solicitation for a credit card from Bank of America.
Open this one for me and tell me what you think. That's from Bank of America. And on the back, it says 0% intro APR.
But that is a asterisk or whatever the mark. So I have to now read that footnote. I will have to remove my glasses to read it. It says, for this, see disclosure summary, insert for details. And I have to find a disclosure summary, which is the one here. So on the outside, it says 0% intro APR. In here, it says that my APR is 11.9, 15.9, or 19.9, right? And the APR you receive is determined based on your creditworthiness. So I have no idea which one I'm going to get when they approve me.
So disclosure, you say, doesn't work.
I mean, look how much time it takes for both of us to
exactly.
go through this. I think that your average consumer is not going to be able to translate what the real pricing is.
Now, you put out statements like this for Providian?
We did, absolutely.
The complaint that led to this legislation is that the credit card industry was abusing its customers.
Well, the vast majority of cardholders manage their credit well, but there was a group that was confused, and that's what Congress and the press were reacting to.
And those people, how many of them are there? Millions? The confused? I mean, are those the people who are going bankrupt?
Most of the people who end up in bankruptcy or who end up with credit card problems, the underlying problem isn't the credit card. Most customers managed their credit cards well, understood them, but there was a segment that was confused, and they realized that it had to be addressed.
But Senator Dodd and others have said to us, the industry got arrogant. You started using all these practices that created this problem.
Well, once Congress and the regulators identified the problems, they've addressed it, and the industry's moving on.
That was Nessa Fetis, the vice president of the American Bankers Association, talking to Frontline correspondent Lowell Bergman. An excerpt from The Card Game, which airs next Tuesday, November 24th, 9 p.m. Eastern Time on PBS. Award-winning investigative journalist and Frontline correspondent Lowell Bergman joins us now from University of California, Berkeley, where he teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism. We welcome you to Democracy Now! This is a follow-up to your secret history of the credit card. Can you take us from there? I don't think people—well, obviously, they don't know it, as you talk about the secret history, right through what you're looking at today, Professor Bergman.
Well, I guess my initial interest in this subject area came from many years of reporting on organized crime, and a question that I kept asking various prosecutors—I remember interviewing, in fact, in the first documentary, then Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, and in New York, and asked him, can you enforce the loan sharking laws in New York when it comes to banks? And he said yes, and off camera, his aide told him, no, you can't. In fact, what happened, and it was a series of unintended consequences 30 years ago, is that the lid came off of interest rates in the United States federally for banks. And what that's meant is when you see your credit card bills, some people now have had their rates just arbitrarily changed to 30%. That's way above most state usury laws, that those traditional laws that kept interest rates down to a level where people could actually pay them. And actually, almost every state in the United States has had these caps up until 30 years ago. And so this began in terms of my trying to understand how this happened. And the results of all of this, and I say it was unintended consequences 30 years ago about what was going on in the economy, is that we had the birth of the modern credit card industry in the United States, something uniquely American, where people could live beyond their means and eventually got so far beyond their means that the whole business, in a sense, today, is in danger of collapse. Credit cards, which were the profit center for banks in the United States, are now great centers of losses. And that's why you're experiencing, if you have one, and most people have five in their wallet, you're noticing that your credit line is being reduced or your interest rate's being raised. That's because of the great losses that are going on as a result of the economic crisis.
Talk about Anita Holliday, a 91-year-old woman in Florida.
Well, people are seeing, are opening up their mail and finding out that they may have a credit card balance, and all of a sudden the rate on that balance, the interest rate, which affects your monthly income, has changed. And that's because traditionally, and this will, by the way, the law that was passed and that President Obama signed last May during Memorial Day weekend really doesn't go fully into effect until February. So as a result, the credit card companies, which were already changing their rates and balances, went into full gear and have lifted rates for all kinds of customers. In essence, what they're trying to do is get rid of what they see are potential losses, and they're desperately trying to get as much income as they can. So that's affecting people on fixed incomes. That's affecting any number of people who've been using credit cards for small business purposes. They're self-employed, and so it's costing people more and more money. And the result is people are being pounded in addition to the problems of getting jobs in this very difficult economy.
Hmm. Can you talk about the legislation now on Capitol Hill, about the heavy lobbying that's going on, the Federal Reserve Board announcing new rules for banks to remove their credit card practices, and in May, Congress passing the Credit Card Accountability, Responsibility and Disclosure Act of 2009, which won't become effective until, what, next February?
Right. In the documentary, we go through the sort of history, try to reprise some of the history from the prior documentary, and then present you with a situation today. Up until this year, the financial services lobby, which includes the banks and 8,000 banks in the United States, and particularly the bigger banks, have been able to lobby Congress so as to stop almost any new regulation. That's changed this year because of this sort of upswelling of anger out there of customers as to what was happening to them with their banks. Congress took recommendations that had been made by the Fed, which hadn't done anything for decades related to the industry, and turned them into this law, which President Obama signed. The law, however, is very narrow, and there are plenty of loopholes in that law. And so to make up for that, based upon consumer advocates and various people's proposals that the regulation of credit cards in particular, but financial consumer lending in general, needed to be centralized in one place, the administration proposed this past summer a new consumer financial protection agency that would take the powers from the different sort of alphabet soup of agencies that you may have heard the names like FDIC, OCC, as well as the Federal Reserve, and put them all in one central regulator that would look out for consumers. That's what the Senate Banking Committee is looking at in debate this week and next week, and possibly the committee will be voting on. It's something that the House Financial Services Committee has already voted on and taken out of committee. And the banks are furiously both trying to some banks are trying to, and lobbyists are trying to defeat that act as well. And if they can't do that, water it down. I think the larger banks in the reporting that we've done, both for the Frontline documentary and the New York Times, are coming to the conclusion that this agency is probably going to exist. So they're trying to figure out what to do around all of this. And that's what we're in the middle of right now, is how do we regulate consumer lending going into the future? And one of the key issues that's going to be discussed, I'm sure, in Congress is how do you do that at the same time that the banks are claiming that they're in such poor financial health that they can't afford the losses that are mounting. Now, let me just explain, back up for a second, and say that the way that what's turned out, there's an interesting phenomenon with credit cards, and that is that the loss rate for credit cards normally had been around 4%. That's what the banks factor in when they charge all these fees and when they set an interest rate. Well, that loss rate usually parallels unemployment. And as we all know, unemployment is now up to the real unemployment rate is at a post-depression high. Well, the bank's losses are that high as well. So the critical economic question and the thing that's going to influence all of our lives in terms of consumption is how much regulation can the banks stand? Are the banks making any money in this business anymore? Will they have to get a new business model and develop that? And will credit cards, debit cards, and the other things that we use every day change dramatically? It appears it will be. Whether or not, in fact, there's any legislation, it looks like it's going to continue to be not only hard, but much harder to get a consumer loan.
How have things changed, Lowell Bergman, from The Secret History of Credit Cards, your first documentary on this that has run repeatedly, to the one that is airing on Tuesday, The Card Game?
Well, the big change is that the industry basically could do whatever it wanted up until a year, year and a half ago, when in the midst of the economic crisis and as the unemployment rate started to rise, started to incur great losses in this business. When we first did the first film, most people didn't know really. If you ask people how do credit cards work, they really don't know, and still many people don't know. And the industry, in a sense, liked it like that. They could get away with, for instance, as we explained in the first film, a 0% interest come-ons, various kinds of gimmicks to market with and get people to take these credit cards and get them into a cycle of debt. How have things changed now? People are going bankrupt. Credit cards are no longer that, if you will, a greater profit center for the industry. And on top of that, it appears that the Congress and the politicians, despite the fact that the industry, financial services industry, pours the most money into Congress and congressional campaigns of any single lobby. So if you understand that they've spent, despite the fact that we're bailing the banks out with hundreds of billions of dollars, that they spent hundreds of millions of dollars this year in Washington for lobbying. Even with all of that money, their political clout is in many ways getting diluted because of the objective situation out there and the amount of unhappiness people have with banks. You know, we're doing a piece for this Sunday, and this is a preview for it. I mean, most of the surveys and most of the studies have shown that banks and credit cards in particular are amongst the most unpopular and the subject of most complaints of consumers in America. And that's catching up with
Lowell Bergman, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Frontline correspondent, professor at the Berklee Graduate School of Journalism. The PBS Frontline documentary, The Card Game, will air on Tuesday night on PBS. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Voto Gattuso, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamath, Nicole Salazar, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen. Special thanks to the whole team, including Peter Curries, Nick Gilla, Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Karen Bernucci. Special thanks also to Stanford Video. Tonight I'll be in Santa Barbara, then moving on to Los Angeles, Pasadena, Fresno, Davis, Sacramento. Chico will be in Ashland, Eugene.